Moncrief on News Talk.
In June 1972, BEA Flight 548 came down near Staines. 118 people died. One day after it happened, the Conservative government ordered an independent inquiry into the crash to find out how it happened and to make sure it never happened again. So, a criminal investigation will seek to find out who planted that bomb. But what we should be asking is how it happened. How did a bomb get through airport security and onto Flight 103? Were mistakes made? Were threat warnings ignored? Why is there so much secrecy around this? We have a right to know.
That's Lockerbie, A Search for Truth. You can stream all episodes now on Sky Atlantic and Now TV. James Dempsey joins us once again. Happy New Year, James.
Happy New Year to you.
This is kind of a, I know it's a dramatization of a story that might already be well known.
I have to admit it wasn't particularly well known to me. Now, I mean, I knew obviously of the Lockerbie bombing, but I didn't know of Jim Swire, Dr. Jim Swire, played here by Colin Firth, and his decades-long search for justice, and justice kind of in inverted commas here as well, because it's sort of, an, you know, there's a lot of mystery surrounding this bombing, and his search for it goes on for decades within the show. So there's a lot of kind of red herrings and garden paths gone down and never really substantial answers gotten to.
Yeah.
But all in, for me, this is a five-part drama, and it actually, it starts really strong. Right. And like, undoubtedly, when you approach a show like this, you're going to think about how are you going to film the Lockerbie bombing itself without making it sort of lurid, but also making it thrilling. And that bit I found absolutely thrilling. I mean, most of it is filmed, or how they choose to do it is really from the ground. I mean, OK, we do see a few people in the plane beforehand, you know, singing Christmas carols, because obviously the bombing happened on the 21st of December. But most of it is seen... You know, the accident and the bombing itself is seen from the perspective of the people in the town of Lockerbie. And I found it thrilling and absolutely terrifying as, you know, things are plummeting from the sky while people are going around their various Christmas to-ing and fro-ing. And then watching that, I was sort of struck by, you know, why have they released this so close after Christmas,
you know,
right? In that kind of no man's land of, well, post-Christmas blues. But I guess it is a particularly sad story, so maybe they didn't want to have it in the Christmas canon of their Christmas catalogue, shall we say. But all in, the problem for me then is as we get further into the show, right? So like it starts with the bombing and then we follow Colin Firth as the father of Flora Swire, who perished along with everyone else in the plane. And his wife is Jane, played by Catherine McCormack. She gets far more short shrift here in the sense that she's kind of, you know, he's the daring do GP hero, doggedly searching for the truth for decades, while she is at home kind of clutching her pearls and feeling sad and moping around the house. And, you know, I don't mean to make light of the tragedy that they suffered, which obviously was terrible, but how she is portrayed here in this drama is the wife.
Yes, you know, okay, right? The suffering spouse.
The suffering spouse, whereas it's kind of the Colin Firth show.
Yeah.
And like the Jim Swire adventures that he takes part in his quest for the truth do make for really interesting ideas, right? You know, he travelled to Libya, I think, more than once, met with Colonel Gaddafi, the despotic leader of a country you weren't supposed to travel to. At one point, he makes a fake bomb and travels to the US and from New York, from JFK to Boston, to prove that, like, security standards have not improved at all.
Yeah.
So he was a very, or I think he's still alive, but he as a character, he's a very interesting person to follow because he takes these cavalier risks while being this very respectable British kind of type. But the more we get into it, the kind of, because this is based on a book that he wrote, the kind of fidelity to every single aspect of the case becomes a bit kind of monotonous, right? So it eventually leads to this much well-known trial that takes place in a neutral country in the Netherlands. And there's these several gotcha moments in the trial, but they come along with so much other things in the trial that it's kind of hard to know which one is the one that you as the audience are supposed to go, oh, Right, that's right, what they're kind of uncovering. So it gets a bit muddled around the justice parts. And then, of course, because it's called Lockerbie, A Search for Truth, it's all about justice in the latter half of the show. And it's much messier in kind of trying to figure out exactly the narrative that it wants to tell. And it becomes a bit plodding. And that's very frustrating because, as I said, it begins with this really, you know, breathtakingly audacious and terrifying crash moment.
Yeah.
Now, it's not the only Lockerbie show we're getting this year. The BBC is putting the finishing touches on a six-part series, which is coming later on in the year.
Is that a dramatisation as well?
Yes. So that's going to star Merritt Weaver of Nurse Jackie and a few other things, and one of the sex education alum, Connor Swindles, and a guy from Suits, Patrick J. Adams. And that's going to also be a decades-long thing as well, because I think the most recent update in the case was either as recently as 2022. So considering it began on the 21st of December 1988, they have a lot of ground to cover. And that also is a kind of issue with a show like this, right? Because we're supposed to be following Colin Firth and, you know, Catherine McCormack and their family as they're getting older and moving through life. And nothing really seems to be changing except there's a few more grey hairs put into the wig as we go through it. And like, I remember the 90s. I don't remember it being as kind of 70s brown as they have portrayed it here. But like, all in, as I said, if you're looking for kind of a meaty justice drama, you're not going to get that here. But if you're looking for an occasionally thrilling beginning, you'll definitely get that.
Yeah, because I imagine it's probably like a procedural, really. There's a lot of talking about evidence and
exactly, there's a lot of this could be the linchpin to our case. Is this the linchpin to our case? No, it isn't. We'll move on to the next one, and that happens over and over and over again. It is at its absolute best in the first two episodes, even where it's laying out some of the kind of facts there and then. But I guess I'll reserve judgment until the end of the BBC one to see which one did it better.
Yeah, and at the start of the series, because you know, my memory is that Jim Squire, when he initially started campaigning in this way, I don't want to use the word crank, but was kind of regarded as a very hurt parent who was clutching at straws, trying to find some other explanation to the, you know, the official one. But then over time, people started to accept that, yes,
maybe he was onto something.
Yeah, no,
and they do portray that as well, which is why it's even more, you know, the contrast between him and his wife character becomes even more difficult, because he is this increasingly conspiracy theoretical type, even though he's really, you know, he doesn't go as far as to having a million like red strings pinned to the wall pieces of evidence. It's not quite that unhinged, but no, it does follow that through, and you do see his interaction with the other surviving families of the victims, how they are frustrated with him and angry with him. But again, that all plays out in excruciatingly long detail. You know, we kind of, if we see it once, we see it about five times, and it's made extremely clear.
Yeah. Right. Okay. The next two shows, both have numbers after them. This is Squid Game Season 2. You can stream all episodes now on Netflix. Here's a clip.
Player 456, you remember this car? We've spoken here once before.
So this is the car, huh? I didn't think it'd be such a cushy limo.
I honestly hoped you would have a good life. That you'd put the past behind you and find happiness.
Oh, it's so touching to hear you really care. I'm moved. I could almost cry.
You should have gotten on that plane. That was the best choice you could have made.
You know, I still think about it. That conversation we had back then. That's the entire reason I wanted to meet you so badly.
Well, here I am. Say what you want to say. What do you want from me?
Obvious question, James. Can you replicate the initial thing, the initial shock and thrill of that initial series?
Well, I don't know. I don't think you can replicate it. I think Squid Game is kind of one of those lightning in a bottle moments, that it's this Korean drama that really conquered the world. I mean, it is still to this day Netflix's most watched thing by a very, very, very long margin. Mm. And considering it's in, you know, the Korean language, and obviously we focus almost entirely on English language material in this slot, and you know, in our viewing in general, it was this incredible breakthrough moment. Now, what I remember saying about Squid Game in 2022, I think is when it was released, was the thing that struck me the most about it was the sets and the production design. And yeah, that still is the case to this day. I mean, there's this one challenge in this version of the show, which, if you are unfamiliar, is about pretty desperate Koreans getting involved in this life or death game for money. And there's this one game where they're on a merry-go-round and they have to go into rooms and groups. And it's just shot so spectacularly well. I mean, it just looks like this creepy, weird 1950s childhood fantasy with a load of death playing at the same time. Now, what I will say I found frustrating in this second coming is that although it has been delayed and, you know, I think it'll be hard to have avoided the news that it ends on a cliffhanger, season three is coming in 2025. They shot seasons two and three back to back.
Right.
And season three will be the finale of the entire thing. So I expect we can expect it to go out on an even bigger bang than it has gone out this time. For me, it kind of works and doesn't work at the same time. So there are seven episodes here. Some of them are an hour and 15. Some of them are about an hour. So you're talking about, you know, a meaty drama. And it all comes from the same guy. His name is Hwang Dong-hyuk. He wrote it. He directed it. He edited it. His fingerprints are all over it. This is his baby. And we get, as we heard in the clip, which is obviously the dubbed version there, we get the news that the survivor of the original Squid Game, which I guess doesn't count as a spoiler, only one person is going to do it, is returning to the game for a second time round because years later he's living on with the guilt and cannot cope. And when it gets back into the game...
So he decides to go back for more?
Basically. I mean, okay, it's a bit more convoluted than that. But yeah, right? And when it gets back into the game, it's brilliant. Like, I can't deny it, right? The way he understands, Hwang Dong-hyuk understands how to completely and utterly manipulate your viewer sympathies for the players of this game is fantastic. He does it by creating different little factions. You know, in the original series, I think we followed a group of like three or four together. This time, at the beginning, we actually followed two separate teams. Four of them, these kind of losers in the game that nobody thinks are going to go anywhere. But of course, they've got hearts of gold, so they'll make it a little bit.
Yeah.
And then our hero, who has been surrounded by others. And he's constantly trying to get people to quit the game. And what they've added this time around is that before every round, the players are allowed to vote on whether they'll stay or whether they'll leave. So it is this character exploration of greed, but also desperation and what people are willing to do for money and how desperate your situation must be if you're willing to literally put your life on the line for a madcap game in neon plastic bright glow colours. Now, what doesn't work is there's also this kind of supporting narrative story going on about a policeman on a boat trying to find an island where this is all taking place. And I assume this will come to more fruition in series three when they tie it all together.
Yeah, because I thought at the end of series one, I don't know if it was explicit, I can't remember now, or it was certainly implied that the baddies, the gangsters who were organising all these things, like that cartel had been broken up. And
I can't recall, to be honest with you. All I recall was they had these terrible like English dialogue moments with these VIPs watching the show. And fortunately, that has been separated from the show. What I did really like as a narrative thread, however, because the detective story did absolutely nothing for me, is if you are familiar with the iconography of the show, there's, you know, the people in the green tracksuits, and it's really clever to just, you know, I think it's such a masterstroke to just reduce them to numbers. You know, they are player 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, etc. Because we as Westerners can't remember their names anyway, which is terrible. Yes. But also it makes us acknowledge that they are, you know, there's a person behind the number. But we also this time around follow one of the murderous game controllers in the red suits and black masks, which I thought was a very interesting narrative choice.
Right, okay.
And it kept me very interested. All in, this is a visual spectacle. If you like this kind of, you know, Hunger Games-y, The Running Man.
But if you like the first series, you're not going to come to this and be disappointed.
I don't think so. I think you'll find it a little slow to take off. And definitely, there's no denying that. But once it gets going, it's still very entertaining.
Yeah, fair enough. Something else I would ask similar questions about this. It's The Traitors. Is this season two or three?
Three.
This is season three. It's on Wednesdays, Thursdays and Fridays at 9 p.m. on BBC One. Here's a clip.
I'm not going to sleep tonight because I have not built enough social capital. I have not met. Like, I literally haven't. Oh, people are coming in. Okay. All right. This is good.
Being a faithful is terrifying. Because it's early days, you have very little signal as to whether they would target quiet ones or loud ones. So it's that immense vulnerability that I'm feeling at the moment.
Oh, I don't know. I'm worried.
Only one thing I would say. You know, Claudia spoke and she said, "Traitors, you're gonna kill tonight."
Yeah.
And Linda went like that.
Traitors.
But I mean, it could be nothing. Do you know what I mean? But like, that's the only thing that I had to go on. Yeah, Linda's really one that I can't stop thinking about.
Right, okay, so have they added some sort of twist to this?
I mean, yes, although I have to admit I didn't quite grasp what it was when Claudia Winkleman was delivering it and everyone was dramatic. Because fundamentally, my reaction to this show is it is the most stupid show on television, and yet it is, without a doubt, stupidly entertaining.
Yeah. Right?
So the twist, as far as I can tell, is that this time around, at some point, people will not... At the finale... The people will not find out who the faithful or who the traitor.
Yeah,
who the traitors are, right? And with every minor twist, the reaction of the people in the show is to imagine as if this is groundbreaking information, but really it isn't.
Yeah.
Now nobody is having a better year than Mark Post. Mark Post. I don't know how to say it. He's the Dutch creator of the show. He made it for RTL, which is the Dutch national broadcaster. And like, even just to look, he started it in 2001. And now, I mean, okay, there's versions of it in every major European country. The US one is extremely successful. The Irish one is coming later on this year with Siobhan McSweeney of Derry Girls, who I think is an inspired choice to host it. How it is going to work in Ireland, where everyone knows
everyone. Yeah.
I don't know, but that's their own battle to solve. What works for me in the show is just how camp it is, right? They understood right away that to make a show like this work, you had to just lean into the absolute silliness of it. And for that, my two favourite things in the entire show is they have this wall of selfies that all of the participants have taken that are the least flattering, most like filter, like CGI filtered thing you've ever seen in your life. And then they do this bit where the traitors are deciding who they're going to murder on a nightly basis, where the three potential people that they lead up to are then caught candidly by the camera doing random things, including having a full-on shower when they're like a muscled hunk.
Yes.
Right? Even though this clearly involved setup and lighting.
Of course, yeah. There's a camera in my bathroom. Who knew?
But all in, it works because it's such a like... pointlessly silly format, right? They have a group of people sit around a table. We, as the audience, are the omniscient people who know everything. They are just suspecting. There is no rhyme or reason to this entire show. You hear all these people arriving going, "I'm going to think about this. I'm going to apply this kind of deductive reasoning. I'm an expert in body language. I'm a whatever." But the truth is, it's literally a witch hunt.
Yeah.
Where people just go, "Oh, you're the I think it's you." And then they try to convince everyone else. And you, when they pick you, go, "Oh, no, it's not me. It's actually them." And it's just an arguing back and forth, which does make for very entertaining television when we hold all the cards and we have all the information and we are able to follow who is, you know, who's the baddie, who's the goodie.
Yeah.
So it fundamentally works as a kind of very simple good versus bad entertainment spectacle. And yeah, I can't wait for the Irish one to come.
The casting, because like the game is silly, as you said, but it's the casting that really makes it.
Definitely.
You've chosen those people correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you were in any way interested, there is a 10-minute, so the BBC has on its YouTube channel a 10-minute long recap of the winner of last year's The Traitors and the various machinations that player did in order to get their way to the top, which is a fantastic 10-minute kind of taster for the show.
Mm.
But what's also really telling is that this was the BBC's flagship show on New Year's Day, and New Year's Day has now become arguably as important as Christmas Day in the viewing kind of scheduling, because things are so fractured now in our viewing. I mean, the only kind of Christmassy thing really that was on was Wallace and Gromit and Gavin and Stacey, and
yeah,
both of them did gangbusters, but this did really, really good business on New Year's Day because this appeals to all family members, all ages, all, you know, it like, because what is it? It's a bunch of people sitting around a table pointing fingers at each other.
Yeah, yeah. Did any of them actually use the phrase deductive reasoning?
I don't think so. But,
yeah.
But the one who was like, I'm an expert in communication.
Figuring out stuff.
was gone pretty quickly.
Yeah. Right, those three shows are Lockerbie, A Search for Truth. You can stream all my episodes now on Sky Atlantic and Now TV. Squid Game 2. You can stream all the episodes now on Netflix. And The Traitors, that's Wednesdays, Thursdays and Fridays, 9 p.m. on BBC One. James Dempsey, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.